Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to a brand new episode of Happy Mum, Happy Baby, the podcast. Today's guest is a keen DIYer and gardener. Honestly, I get lost on your Instagram page so often. It makes me want to grab my toolkit and see what I can knock together. I don't feel like anything will actually be up to your standards. I can remember being at uni and having things I wanted to put up on the walls for ages and having a glass of wine and going, I'll do it now. Just shove some nails in very random places. But I mean, that's the extent to my DIY. He's actually already a part of the Happy Mum, Happy Baby family. You've done so much for us online within the community, and I can't thank you enough on that. He's someone who talks a lot about adoption because he's been through it. He's an adoptive dad of three children, two daughters who were adopted in 2013, and a son, their sibling, who joined the family a couple of years ago. Today's guest is James from the DIY Dads. Hello.
Hello. Lovely to catch up with you.
James, what was your childhood like? Where did you grow up?
So I grew up in Southampton with my parents. So I've got two brothers. So I was the sort of difficult, quiet middle child, really.
I'm middle child.
Yeah, you can tell them. You can always spot them, can't you? Absolutely. So, and I had, relatively happy sort of childhood, really, pretty nondescript. My older brother was quite poorly all through sort of childhood. So used to spend quite a lot of time in school holidays and things like that in hospital waiting rooms and playrooms and stuff. So, which was sort of a little bit different when you sort of think back now and I think about the amount of hours and stuff that we probably spent as a family, but kind of like locked and kind of in quite a confined space. It seems quite strange when you kind of look back, but a really happy childhood, actually, despite all of that. And just had a really sort of lovely time growing up. Very fortunate that I had lots of sort of family, kind of friends and stuff like that, kind of sort of local to us. So it was pretty calm and pretty nondescript, really, as childhood's going.
Yeah. And looking ahead to the future, did you ever see yourself becoming a dad and what that would look like?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I don't know. I always imagined children in our lives. And I think as I grew up and probably played quite a avuncular kind of role, I guess, in sort of friends and nephews and nieces sort of childhood. So was always kind of like dived in and sort of got quite hands on with them. And whether it's babysitting, whether it was kind of taking them out for weekends or even on family holidays and stuff like that, taking some of our friends' children with us. But yeah, it always seemed like it was going to happen. I think it was just sort of deciding what was the right sort of journey, really, to kind of have that kind of parenting route, really. And and that's where kind of adoption sort of crept into the sort of peripheral vision, really. And came
when you met your partner, was a family something that you talked about early on? Were you both very much on the same page?
Yeah, absolutely. Which is really nice, actually, because I think a lot of same-sex couples probably don't always have that, and quite often I've heard of same-sex couples where they've had quite different views, actually, and had to kind of navigate that and see whether that's a kind of route they wanted to kind of continue with. So it was lovely. We sort of discussed it very, very early on, and I think for me, it probably would have always been a deal breaker because I always saw children in our lives. So I think that would have always been quite a massive hurdle to overcome had I met somebody that had a very different view to that. And it's one of those things, I think, growing up and exploring and trying to kind of get my head sort of straight, if you like, if you excuse the pun, in terms of what my life was going to look like. That was probably the biggest thing to come to terms with around, actually, if this is who I am and, you know, I identify the way that I do. The thought of then not having children was always something that felt like it was a bigger deal than actually the coming out and all the other bits. It was kind of processing.
Well, it's interesting.
That.
So we had H on from Steps last series, and he made the point that actually when we were younger, there wouldn't have been same-sex couples that had kids. Like, we just didn't see that.
No, there was no reference points. And actually, I remember the first contact we had with our adoption agency that we contacted, the first question was, are we allowed to do it? Is that what we're able to do? And, you know, I mean, we're not talking, you know, that long ago, really, but I think it was 2012 when we started making those contacts. But it's just not clear. And there was none of that kind of presence, I guess, to kind of work out whether that was something that we were able to kind of follow. And I think it was only a few years before we actually started that process that the law meant that actually only one of you could adopt the child legally, and actually the other person was just a co-parent that happened to live in the same house, and you had to make that judgment call around who was going to be the legal parent and who was just a guardian that lived in that home. So, you know, it's all of those sort of nuances in terms of law we were trying to kind of get our heads around at that kind of early kind of exploration stage. And it's difficult when you don't see that representation. I think it's hard to kind of work out what that could look like. And
did you have to kind of go, what, you know, did you ever think about surrogacy, or was it always adoption that you were being pulled towards?
Yeah, I think it always was adoption. I think the reality of, or the opportunity, I guess, to support a child that was already born, that was already here, that was already looking for a bit of a break, maybe, you know, slightly vulnerable or needed that stability of a home, that's what we felt like we could provide. So we never kind of explored surrogacy. And I know, you know, lots of people that have and, you know, have, you know, just the most amazing family. So, you know, what's right for one isn't right for another. But for
Absolutely.
Us, it was always, we always had that pull. I had a couple of friends that I went to sort of college and uni with and stuff that ended up doing social work. So it was kind of always around. I always kind of got a sense of it and heard snippets of the sorts of children that were coming into care or the ones that were looking. And I remember sort of just thinking, I think when the time is right, that's where I would naturally gravitate to, I think.
How did you come to the point where you were like, now's the right time? Because obviously you spoke about it early on, you said, but point were you like, actually, now's the right time to start going about it properly? And where did you start?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think it was 2012 when it was actually when all the Olympics and everything was going on. And I remember sitting in a friend's garden, we wheeled out the TV and we were watching some of the Olympic stuff that was going on. I think it was that Super Saturday where there was all the kind of races and all the cool stuff going on. And it just felt quite content. We'd lived in our house for a few years. We'd sort of done a lot of renovation stuff. We're both quite stable at work. It just naturally, I remember just sitting there and thinking, oh, actually, you know, we could do this. We could have a couple of children running around and we could kickstart this now. And so we started getting the ball rolling. And I remember how we contacted our local agency and they sent us a letter to say, oh, could you come to our open evening? And it was that kind of local sort of church hall. And again, our kind of preconceptions of religion and same-sex couples and all this, we sort of said, oh, I'm not sure how welcome we're going to be, but let's go for it and let's get the ball rolling. And we remember kind of creeping into this kind of hall and just seeing this kind of like table of all these kind of really scary textbooks and things about adoption and the children in care and written by psychologists and all these kind of very, very, you know, intellectual people. But it was really, really intimidating because when you are presented, I think one of the books was A Boy That Was Raised as a Dog. There was a book around, you know, dealing with emotionally traumatized children. And that was our welcome. That was our kind of introduction to this world. And it just felt quite intense, actually. Just trying
Do you
to think.
Think that's done in that way to kind of go, I don't know, to take out or to give a reality check about what people might be walking into? Kind of, this isn't going to be plain sailing. You know, you're not just going to be given a child and that's it. You know, it's actually, there's so much more that goes with it.
Yeah, I think so. And I think the agencies do a brilliant job. And I've had the opportunity since to work with the agencies in a more kind of voluntary capacity. And I think even at that stage, I think what's really, really apparent is that there are so many unknowns with these children, with the journeys that you're going to go on, the experiences that you'll probably end up having to do. And that ability to feel quite resilient and comfortable in that ambiguity of what that journey could look like and what that child might end up needing. You know, for a child, I mean, you get these massive reports all about the children to explain their experiences and what they've what maybe that prognosis is going to be long term for them. But it's only what they know. You know, there are things that might have happened to that child that only, you know, their birth parents and them will know about, and and that might come out much later. And when they're, you know, really settled, they might start sharing some of that and some of those experiences. So, yeah, it's, you have to have that ability, I think, to be able to navigate that and know where your limitations are when you need to put your hand up and say, actually, this feels quite tough. I might need an expert here, or I might need to bring someone in that might be able to give me some better advice. So I think it's, you're right, it has to be front loaded. You have to go into it with your eyes open that that is a potential reality. Because I think if you don't, it'll be quite a rude awakening. And I think for all of that investment that social workers and those teams kind of put into sort of taking you through that process, nobody wants that to break down. We don't want an experience where that child has another amount of trauma because they've moved to a home, the home that they've moved to, their adoptive parents weren't equipped or weren't prepared to take on that ambiguity. And then it becomes another sense of loss because that placement breaks down and they move on. So I think it has to be that harsh from almost day one, because otherwise it's you're going into a blind, I think.
And it's a long process though, from that moment to actually getting approved to adopt. It's a long process between that, and it's invasive as well. And rightly so, because of everything that you've highlighted. But it's you have to go through a lot to be able to get to that approval point.
Yeah, absolutely. And I always kind of think of it as almost a game of two halves, because you've got this piece which is all around the agency getting to know you. And again, that's about it's called an assessment process, and that's, you know, sometimes feels like quite a harsh word, but I think it's a reality of nobody wants that placement to break down. So if there's anything in your lives or your history or your past that ultimately is going to impact that child having that stability that they desperately need after whatever they've had before them, then you want to kind of bring that up. And I've heard a lot of people call it sort of free therapy. You go through this kind of process of reflecting on your own childhood and reflecting on your own things like attitudes to education and religion and identity, all of the things that are going to be really important for that child that moves in with you. You kind of explore that. And then on the opposite side, it's that kind of preparation. It's equipping you with the tools and the experience and the techniques that are going to help you support this child that isn't a brand newborn baby, but is coming with their own baggage of experiences or behavioural kind of challenges or their own kind of things that they're going to need support and that stability with. So it's that balance of those two things. And I think the process is, you know, intense. I think we started it in the January of 2013 and we were approved in the October. So, you know, 9 months, ironically, you're kind of going from start, you know, start to that kind of point. And there were times where it felt like everything was coming at us, because we were doing a training course, we were trying to read a book that we needed to read, we were having the assessment visits. And then there were months where we didn't hear anything and we were sort of chasing daily almost to say, come on, we're ready, what's going on, what's the hold up. So it all the way through, it just feels like it's a bit of a test, it's a bit of a push. And I think if you can, the attitude we took to it, where it was kind of a means to an end, if I'm honest, we kind of got to ourselves to a point of it's a process and it's an engine and you have to kind of go through that kind of machine of the assessment that you need to do. I think looking back on it now, I would definitely be asking questions as we were going through to just quantify and understand what they were trying to kind of get, because at times it seems so, I don't know, it just wasn't tangible of actually the question they were asking versus what it was that they actually wanted or were trying to understand.
What was it like when you got told that you had the approval?
So the first
time... And how do you get told that?
Yeah, so the process has kind of evolved a little bit. So when we went through the process with our daughters, we kind of got almost a bit of an instant decision. So you go to what's called a panel, so an adoption panel. You have a kind of room full of people that have a real mix in terms of their experience. So, but all have a kind of affinity to adoption or children in care. So there was sort of retired head teachers, there was a GP in the room, there was somebody that was an ex-social worker, there was somebody that probably about sort of 70 or 80 that had been adopted kind of back in the 30s or something, and they were kind of there from their perspective. There was people that were foster carers. So there's a whole room of people from that kind of community. And you sort of go into the room, you sort of shuffle in, you get asked some questions and you kind of do your best to kind of answer them. Go back out of the room, they leave the social worker in and have a chat about you, and then you get called back in. And the sort of decision's quite instant, so they'll kind of share that with you and say, this is our kind of recommendation. And we, by that point, we'd got ourselves to a point where we sort of said that we'd sort of would consider siblings, and that was something that we wanted to pursue.
Is that something that's desperately sort of sought after as well?
Yeah, massively. Yeah, massively. And I think that need is just growing, actually. I think what we're seeing in terms of, you know, recruitment agencies, I think actually quite a few recruitment agencies and in terms of adoption now, if people are looking for sort of a baby under the age of 12 months and just one child, actually don't have the resources to assess because there's such a big need for siblings and for kind of older children. So, we evolved actually as we went through the process. I think we started off sort of with one child in mind and definitely evolved as we kind of went through it and thought, don't want to go through this process again. We just thought, actually, let's complete this. Let's do it in one go. And also, if you do it in stages, you end up having to then the children have to go through that assessment process as well to make sure they're secure and they're in a position where that will be a positive impact to their lives. So we kind of sort of said, actually, do you know what? We always said we'd do it, you know, we'd have multiple children. Let's do it. Let's take the opportunity to support a sibling group that was in care that are kind of quite hard to place. So we just sort of thought, let's kind of do it. And we got that decision instantly. So they sort of said, look, we're really comfortable that you could take on a sibling group. So that was great. That then comes through in writing about 10 days later, and you get an official kind of letter from sort of the agency decision maker. And then you start that kind of family finding kind of process. It sort of kind of kicks off almost instantly, really, of the sort of social workers trying to then kind of piece together but sort of air traffic control, I guess, the children that are kind of coming up through the courts that they know that they need to place, the parents that they've got that have been assessed and are at that approval stage, doing that kind of matching up really to try and kind of connect those sort of two things together.
So do they come to you with different groups of children, or, you know, is it a case of we've found the children that we think are right for you?
Yeah, we were presented with our daughter straight away. So I was at work and I remember getting a phone call from our social worker and just said, oh, just to let you know, it was a couple of days actually after we'd been to panel, and she sort of said, look, the agency...
Gosh, so soon after as well.
Yeah. I think we went to the panel on the Wednesday and we were sort of told, look, wait for 10 days and we'll contact you in 10 days. We've got it. And then on the Friday I was at work and I sort of answered the phone and it was the call. Yeah, they wouldn't tell us anything over the phone, but they said, look, we have got some children that we've been sort of considering for you for a while. We're just waiting for you to get it sort of through approval. So I'd like to have that kind of conversation with you. And they just sort of said to us, look, it's two girls. One of them was born in sort of March 2013. And she said, and the other one was born in March. And I was like, I was writing it down at the time. I said, oh, what year? And she said, oh, no, this year. They were born this year. So we were always kind of thinking we would start to get sort of placed with sort of slightly older children. So that was kind of quite a bit of a kind of moment of kind of thinking actually we could be faced with sort of two children under the age of two. And then the social worker came around on the Monday, so we had that kind of weekend of just trying to sort of churn over and process what it was. And she came and sat down and she sort of whipped out this sort of dog-eared bit of paper that she'd obviously had in her briefcase kicking around for ages and had like a T-ring on it, which had this little little profile. It had like a couple of little thumbnail pictures and just sort of like two or three lines that just said, you know, the eldest is this, this and this, and the youngest is this, this and this, and just had snippets of information and, you know, just in a way meaningless stuff. It was stuff like, you know, loves the sound of animals, loves running around, which was lovely to hear, but didn't answer any of the questions that we kind of had in our head, but was enough to kind of, just kind of pull you in, I think. And we were kind of hooked then. And yeah, it just kind of went from there, really. We over the space of maybe 2.5 months, just sort of pieced together more and more information and got all of that ahead of sort of finally meeting
them. So you had a bit of time to get yourselves and your house ready for the new arrivals.
Yeah, absolutely. So you sort of go through a process where you go through sort of then almost a mini assessment where for you have a kind of couple of sessions sort of less focused about actually could you be a parent and do you have the skill set and do you have that life that could accommodate children, to then kind of flipping it over to say, and what is it about these particular children that's the right match, that's the right combination? So it was then exploring that around what their needs were or what their scenario was versus ours, and how do those two things fit together, and why are we the best people that would kind of take these two children on? So yeah, that's the kind of mini assessment that then kind of kicks off. And then from that, you go to another panel date. So you get that sort of opportunity to go and see sort of a different group of people, get that decision sort of verified. And then, from that, you kind of start your kind of meeting and your introductions.
And what was it like when you met the girls for the first time, your daughters? Was it, because I imagine, was that just a meeting that first day?
It's very different now. So now there's lots of opportunities for what they call like bump-in meetings, chemistry meetings, so opportunities right. to maybe go to like a communal setting, so like a play park, and the foster carers might take them to the play park and be pushing them on the swings. And as prospective adopters, you could go and maybe meet them and just interact with them sort of from afar almost and do things like that, which I think is lovely. It's a lovely way to kind of start that relationship. The first time we met them was the start of the 7 days when we kind of were going to bring them home.
So you knew that was going to happen at the end of it. So that whole week is gearing up to that.
Yeah, just kickstarting that kind of chunk of time. And we'd already been to the foster carer's home before because we had a meeting with them to kind of talk about their needs and how they're getting on and what milestones they were meeting, all of that kind of stuff, what nappy sizes and stuff they needed. So we'd sort of done all of the homework for that. And I remember just walking through the door and seeing all their little shoes sort of lined up at the foster carers by the front door and seeing that. And it was a really strange one because there was loads of professionals with us. We had our social worker, we had the children's social worker, we had the health visitor, we had the team manager, we had the two foster carers. So everybody was sort of crammed in this very kind of small space. And our eldest, she was about 18 months at the time. I just remember her kind of pushing past all of these legs. And I sort of looked down and I just saw these kind of massive blue eyes. I just instantly kind of crouched down and was kind of eye level with her. And she had her sister's like muslin cloth that she was sort of, the foster carer was using. And she just threw it over my head and she just started playing peekaboo with me like instantly. And it was just such a surreal thing because it just felt like after you sort of kid ourselves all the way along that we were kind of looking for the children. And then actually they're the ones that kind of come and find you out. They you know, completely come and found us. And yeah.
And but you must think about that moment a lot before going into it. Like, I think any parent, you think about that bond and there's so much pressure around the bond of, you know, your baby, your child is in your arms, they're in front of you. Is that love there instantly? Are they going to love you? Is there going to be a connection between you? So there must be, well, I don't know, was there a lot of pressure on that moment? And I imagine the nerves between you and your partner walking into the foster carer's home must have been massive.
There is that massive amount of pressure because you know that everybody's looking and watching you. But you're also in somebody else's home. You're also, I mean, our eldest had been with that foster carer for 18 months. So there was that such deep-rooted kind of relationship that it felt like it was their child we were taking away, not somebody else's. And so you sort of almost didn't know whether you could, you know, I was kind of walking up thinking, oh, do you go over? Do you touch the child? Are you allowed to kind of, you know, grab the hand? Are you, how does this work? And obviously it didn't matter because the children lead it and completely kind of nailed it in terms of what that was going to look like in terms of a kind of initial meeting. And it was fine. And within 2 minutes, I remember you were playing peekaboo for a little bit. And then we kind of sort of went back into their main living room. And she sort of did that thing that sort of 2-year-olds do where they kind of shuffle one back into you, don't they? And then sit on your lap. And she sort of sat on our lap. And I had a notebook where I was writing bits and pieces down. And she just put her hand down and we just started making handprints and just drawing around her hand, listening to what everyone else was talking about. Well, not listening as it was, but, you know, and just drawing around her hand. And yeah, that was it. And we still do it now. Every birthday and that, we still kind of do that kind of handprints. And it's just, it just happened. But the children lead it, you know. Sort of kid yourself.
Had she been told anything about you by that point, before that meet?
Yeah, so we did something called an introduction book. So we did kind of a couple of things, actually. So we got printed like a load of photos and we kind of stuck them in a bit of an album. And it was, you know, really cheesy things of like, this is daddy cooking, this is dad in the garden. And it was just different kind of photos of us sort of around the house and doing different things. Just they could get their sort of bearings a little bit and kind of get a sense of who these faces and who they are. And yeah, children are amazing. They're so resilient. They just nail it. They just kind of, you know, suss it out. And I think, they sort of manage that transition so much better than I think we do as adults.
Well, so did you see them every day that week?
Yeah, it was a slow build. So we started on the Monday, we arrived and we sort of did that meeting maybe for an hour and then we all left. And then by the Tuesday, we sort of rocked up at maybe just after breakfast and stayed till just after lunch. And by the Thursday, I think we were taking the girls out on our own and pushing them around on the pushchair and having a few hours by ourselves. By the Saturday, the foster carer were bringing them to our house and they would spend all day with us. And then we would take them back in the evening to the foster carer's house and literally just put them to bed. And we would put them to bed and then we would be there the next morning to pick them up for when they woke up. And then the Tuesday was the last day. So the Tuesday we weren't there when they woke up, but we arrived at 10 o'clock in the morning and we literally walked into the house, picked them up and took them. And that was it. I think we were in the foster carer's house for 2 minutes, I think, in
end-to-end. That must have been such an emotional day on so many levels, because obviously you're taking your daughters home, but at the same time, you must recognise the fact that you're also taking them away from everything that they've known. And I know that you're taking them to their new life of love and family, but I know, you know, for Isma Alma, she was on the podcast years ago, and she said that that was something that really got her, the fact that she was taking her son from, even though you know that you're taking them to love, it's hard to know that you are, you know, that there is that upheaval that you just need to help them get through.
And you know, by design, that fact that it was 2 minutes, you know, that's what it's needed. It's such an emotionally charged moment that you, and the social workers are always there for it, but it's just that final bit. And by that point, we'd already taken like their toys and their sort of clothes and bits and pieces they had. I didn't have massive amounts, but, you know, bits and pieces that they, that were theirs, that weren't kind of necessarily, you know, the foster carer's house that they'd use for the next children they had. The bits that were theirs, we'd already kind of taken.
Which must be nice for them as well when they get to their
new home. Yeah, there's that familiarity. Yeah, absolutely, which is really nice. But yeah, just that moment of just, I remember sort of driving up to the thing, and by that point we built such a relationship as well with the foster carers. Like you have to, because you're in their home and you know, sharing meals together. They're kind of, you're in it together. You have to have that kind of relationship. And then to kind of take them away from everything they've known, it's unbelievable. I mean, we just literally packed them in the car and we drove straight to the beach, actually, and we just stuck them in the pushchair and we just walked for about 2 hours, probably in silence completely, you know, and just walked and just kind of cleared and just sort of, you know, let the kind of wind sort of blow away all the kind of cobwebs and stuff. And then we took them home and then we sort of said, right, okay, this is it now. Shut the door behind us. And this is our kind of incubation period now. This is just for us. This is our time now to kind of suss it out. But yeah, just that sense of taking them away from everything they knew. And
I would imagine as well, that's why it's important for you to have a good relationship with them as well, and why you have kept that relationship, because they know that part of your daughter's lives that you weren't there for. So, you know, it's almost like a piece of the puzzle.
Absolutely. You know, and there's loads of stuff that exists before. You know, there are things that are coming out and things that we're navigating at the moment with the children. And I mean, our girls are coming up to 9 and 10, and there's still stuff that comes out in terms of things like health and things. And we think, goodness, there's a correlation between that and maybe even pre being born and that experience in pregnancy that might have kind of connected those two things. And it's kind of navigating all of that. The jigsaw puzzle is a great analogy for it, because we don't own any of the pieces. We own the, you know, and we can support with the bits that we know. Our role as an adoptive parent is to help the girls and now our son piece all of those bits together, so they've got that clarity of their identity. They've got clarity of their own life. But it's different. And it's different for each of them, actually. You know, it's different experiences that happened for both of our daughters, as much as they're really close in age and they have that shared experience of foster care time. Actually, their experiences during pregnancy were very different. The circumstances that they were carried were very, very different. And that has changed the trajectory for both of them, actually, in terms of how they've developed and grown as well. So it's all of that stuff that we have to navigate. But that's where the preparation up front comes in. That's the toolkit that you're building is allowing you to be able to confidently do that. I think the legacy that we've got with things like, you know, long lost families and stuff like that, where people grow up and they hit the age of 70 and find out they've got a load of other siblings, or that their auntie was actually their mother, and they have to kind of navigate all of that stuff. You know, our role is to make sure that never happens. Our children grow up knowing exactly who they are and how they came to be. And that's quite hard, exactly, because sometimes you do have to share with them stuff that you know isn't maybe always right for a child to know. But they have to have that honesty and that age appropriate knowledge to help them feel safe and secure, so they don't get to the age of 18 or 20 or 30 or 40 and suddenly have a great big revelation in their life and have to kind of emotionally deal with that as well. But that transparency, that's the word I always kind of come back to with adopters that I work with now, is if you're not willing to do that, that just prolongs trauma. It just prolongs that kind of that impact that person, you know, everyone has a right to know who they are, don't they? Everyone deserves to
I guess it's that thing, you can't draw a line under everything that's gone before you became their adoptive dad, but that still exists. It's not like you can go, well, that didn't happen anymore. This is you from now.
Yeah, because, yeah. You know, their birth parents are still their birth parents. Like, that will never change. Like, I've got no right to be able to dictate history and to rewrite that. But what I can do is help them understand the circumstances that mean that it wasn't safe for them to stay there. And actually they need that stability. And, you know, I talk in some of the training sessions that we do now is, you know, we talk about what's all the things that we think a child needs. They need food and warmth and, you know, a place to sleep and a place to rest their head and the stability and routine and to go to school. And sometimes those people can't tick all of those boxes and we have to, help them navigate that and help them understand that. So there's some really good age appropriate ways that you can kind of have that conversation. And you always think you're going to have a big, meaningful conversation around a dinner table with all of you together. And you know, experience dictates that it normally happens in the middle of Sainsbury's when you're pushing around a trolley, that they want to have this big, deep, meaningful conversation and you just have to ride with it and go with it.
Yeah.
But it's taking the children's pace with all of this stuff.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I imagine it's a very different pace going from 2 to 4. Was that quite overwhelming? Was that a big, like, bit of a shock?
It was. And my other half, actually, had a couple of weeks worth of parental leave. But obviously, you know, a week and a half of that was used in the foster carer's home. So I think the girls moved in on the Tuesday and then he was back to work the following Monday. And I remember, like, got off of work and I was like, I just don't know what to do this week. Like, I don't know how this is going to go. Let's work this one out. And quite quickly, I kind of worked out that actually routine was really, really important, and trying to kind of maintain regular, you know, bedtimes, bath times, lunch times, all of that kind of stuff was really important. And I used to just stay at home in the morning, and then regardless of the weather, we used to have lunch, and then I used to put them in a double buggy and I just used to walk for like 2-3 hours just every afternoon. And we just got into that kind of pattern, and they started kind of napping a little bit and sort of settling into that kind of routine. And it was quite overwhelming. I think the hardest thing actually was going to I naively thought I could go to a baby group, it'll be fine. So I kind of rocked up at one of the I think it was Baby Sign. It was kind of January and they were all kind of wrapped up in coats and stuff. And I just sort of unstrapped them into what they were wearing. The sort of 9-month-year-old was sort of crawling towards the stairs. And then the 18-month was sort of emptying someone's handbag over there. And I was like, who do you go after? Like, all of the training and the preparation you've done didn't train you for where you go and what you do in this situation. And obviously, you know, you look around the room and everyone's navigating the same, aren't they? They're trying to kind of bumble along together. But it just felt harder, I think, to try and do that at the age that they were. Whereas I think with a baby, you kind of get that warm-up period, don't you, for a couple of months. There's a load of other challenges. But actually, you know, those sorts of social situations, you can kind of ease yourself into it a little bit more. But yeah, that's how, I think it played out.
You thought your family was complete at this point, a family of four. You thought you'd done it all. You've gone through all of the processes that you could and you've got it.
Yeah.
However, you got a phone call a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. So it was, a couple of years ago, I was at work and I had this very, very, very strange email came through, and it was basically like an encrypted thing. And it said, please, can you put in the following information? And I thought it was like a spam thing. I thought, oh, yeah,
I definitely would think it was a spam thing. There was no way I'm going to put anything into that.
There were two things. The first one was it spam. Or the other thing I thought is like MI5 coming to like recruit me as an agent. There were so many complex things. I thought, this is the moment. This is it. They've come for me.
Well, your DIY skills really are absolutely at that point. You're like, there we go.
Yeah, finally, the call's in. Yeah. So I was kind of like sort of swaying about it, and then. On the bottom of the email, there was a reference point that just connected me back in. Like suddenly my brain jolted and I thought, oh, hang on a second. That's got something that kind of triggered from that kind of past experience. So I put it through and then it literally just came up and it said, Mr. Rands, please could you phone this number? And that was it. And I thought, sure. So I phoned this number and then the person on the end of the line sort of said, oh, I'm so grateful that you phoned. I've just seen that you've just opened my email. And it just said, you know, introduced himself. And said, look, I'm a social worker at this place. Need to talk to you because the shape of your children's birth family has changed, and we want to have a conversation with you. And we were always told in those early days there's you know pretty much sort of two reasons why they would come and speak to you. One is if there was sort of a significant kind of loss or you know critical illness or something like that in the birth family that they need to talk mm-hmm. to you about, or if another sort of sibling had sort of come along. So. I was sort of like bouncing between the two of, I don't know which direction this conversation is going. And quite quickly, she sort of said, just to let you know, there's a baby that's been born and we are just going through sort of a bit of an assessment process to understand whether the circumstances in the birth family has changed, if there's anyone else in the extended kind of birth family that might, you know, want to be considered for this child's future. However, we're sort of getting to the conclusion that's probably, we've probably exhausted all of those things. And sort of the next part of the process is for us to go and sort of speak to you and just get a sense of whether your family's complete or whether you would like to, you know, have a further conversation. And it was really odd because my mind kind of jumped straight away of, yeah, of course, you know, why would we not? Let's kind of see where we go. But again, you kind of then jump back to think, well, is the other person going to be on, you know, my other half's going to be on the same page? So
was this something that you'd ever talked about?
Interestingly, we'd always talked about having sort of other children in our lives. So I think my kind of long-term kind of aim was always sort of to do, you know, a chunk of time sort of, you know, sort of working and then come out of that and maybe look at fostering when the children are older mm-hmm. And maybe sort of go down that route. So I think we'd always considered other children in our lives, but not necessarily, you know, if this call hadn't have came, I don't think, and it wasn't a full kind of birth sibling, I don't think we would have naturally kind of kick-started that kind of process. The girls were really settled. They had a, you know, really lovely life. It was kind of seemed like it was kind of, just wasn't a consideration really. So I had a kind of brief conversation and put the phone down and then spoke to my other half, and my other half was like, well, yeah, let's go and find out. So it was pretty kind of instant straight away. And really, really unfortunately, I then had to get a taxi, go and get on a plane, and I was away for 3 days. And that was really hard because we were sort of then sort of having this kind of conversation for a couple of days, you know, over texts and calls in the evening and stuff. And then by the time I'd come home, we had sort of our fourth bedroom was like a dressing room. It had sort of some wardrobes. I came in and like one wall had been blocked up. All the wardrobes had been sort of knocked down and it was kind of in the process of becoming a nursery. I was like, oh, okay. We're definitely doing this then, are we, sort of thing. And you know, he was kind of there and was kind of, yeah, sort of had started kind of, I don't know, that kind of nesting thing, really. So we then had a very, very sort of suppressed, sort of quick kind of assessment. So didn't need to do the, are you capable of being parents, but actually, is this the right dynamic to chuck into the mix based on how your daughters are doing and where you are in your life? So almost sort of plugging in the information in the last sort of 6-7 years since they last sort of spoke to us.
Had you talked to your daughters about their brother at that point? No.
We didn't straight away, but we gradually kind of started sort of saying, wouldn't it be nice if you had another kind of child? And just sort of started drip feeding that kind of that kind of concept and idea. Because obviously at that point we hadn't been to court, we hadn't sort of done this sort of adoption panel bit, so we didn't know it was a sort of slam dunk. We had still had that sort of uncertainty. But equally, the social worker wanted to meet the girls to kind of just sort of see how they were and interact with them a little bit. So we had a couple of kind of quick meetings on that. And I think it was 3 months from that initial phone call to that moment when he was in our house. It was really quick. And yeah, what was lovely is that in some ways it felt like he'd never, you know, he'd always been with us. He was just instantly kind of slotted in. And I think, yeah, it's probably the same true for many siblings, isn't it? Is you sort of think think it's going to be harder, but actually they just, by the time you get to the third and probably the fourth or the fifth, they just go along with the plus status quo of everything else, don't they? And
what were the girls like when they met him?
They were amazing, actually. They just completely embraced him and really just, kind of, it was instant, that kind of connection that they had with him. And there was such a physical resemblance to our youngest daughter and him that it was really strange, actually. With the moment we met him, it was like sort of going back 6 years. It was going back and just seeing this same kind of baby, really. And the foster carer that was fostering him had a baby the same age that she was also fostering. And we knew we just walked in and was like, oh no, it's here. It's this guy here, sort of thing. So we sort of sussed it out straight away. But the girls were fantastic and really embraced him. And, life did have to change a little bit. There were things where, the girls would do sort of, clubs that lasted quite late and we couldn't always do those. And for a while we couldn't go to the cinema unless it was just one of us taking the girls. And we've had to kind of adjust those sorts of things, which we were quite used to doing. So it's evolved, but they've just embraced it really, really, really well. And I remember when we went through the adoption panel, the sort of chair of the group said, what came through all the way through. And he sort of said why it was such an easy decision to say is that, you just knew it was going to enhance the girls' lives. It wasn't going to take anything away. And I think that's really, I hope that still kind of is true now. I think we're, coming up to 2.5 years. I think that's the case.
A few months after you welcomed your son, you found out that another sibling was, that their birth mother was pregnant at that point, wasn't she?
Yes, it was actually, I think it was 3 days after he moved in that we had a call to say, just to let you know, sort of birth mum's rocked up to doctor surgery and is presenting signs that sort of pregnant. And just a massive one to kind of weigh up and kind of reflect on. And I think where we'd got to is I think it would have started to have a detrimental kind of impact to the three children that we had. I think to chuck another baby in the mix when we were 3 days in with one.
Exactly. This whole new dynamic has just started, knowing that you'd be changing that again in however many months.
Yeah, a lot of soul searching, and I don't know if you ever know if you've done the right thing. I think it's one of those things that probably kind of sort of sit quite heavy for forever, really. But we both had a really, really honest conversation around it had to be the right dynamic for the children, and it didn't feel like so soon that would have been appropriate and that would have been the right thing. And we shared that quite quickly with the sort of social worker teams, and they were fantastic, totally supported that and completely
agreed.
Because
you could get yourself into a position, especially if the birth mum is young, that she could be having a baby. Right.
Exactly. I mean, we were sort of looking body clocks and things like that and thinking, there could be another 12, 13, 14 years of this. Yeah. And we're talking about, a year on, a year on, a year on every time. We just said we just, too much kind of impact. So we kind of had the opportunity to talk quite openly with that with the kind of social workers, and they identified a couple actually that were kind of going through the process that were looking to do more of a kind of foster to adopt placement, and they they picked him up pretty much straight away from hospital and has had him ever since. So they had never had that kind of almost that kind of movement of going to foster care and then on again, and they're
and
doing amazing
up,
well
haven't you?
Yeah, we've had a couple of times where we've kind of had days out and stuff like that. And again, just resilience, children, the girls are just so matter of fact about it and just say, we know we've got another sibling and we know that they don't live with us and that's okay. And we can navigate that. So, they're just quite chilled about it and say, we've got a brother, doesn't live with us, but it's cool kind of thing. So, they just handle these things, don't they? And just embrace it.
But it's like you say, it's letting them all of the kids know the situation. Hmm. No one's being kept in the dark, and that feeling of stability, that feeling of knowing where you've come from and your history, you're giving that to them from the off.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's that sense of identity, isn't it? It's knowing who you are allows you to have that foundation in you, doesn't it? To then whatever life chucks at you, if you're already comfortable and secure and confident in who you are, it's much easier to navigate life, isn't it? It's much easier to kind of yeah, suss the world out if you've got that. So yeah, I think, you know, the attitudes of the family that have adopted the sibling have got the same mindset, and I think they'll continue to do the same too.
Yeah. James, you're really open and honest about your whole adoptive journey. The reason for being so, from what I've read from you, it's not so that everyone goes out and adopts a child. It's so that, well, you tell me, I know that it's not that. So yeah, what is it?
I think for me, life will be so much easier for my children if people understand a little bit more about what their journey has been. And you know, their journey is their journey. It's no one else's. You know, every adoptive family will have a slightly different kind of experience and route. But actually, I think if it's kind of bringing adoption and fostering out of the shadows a little bit, and people seeing it as it's just another route to become a family, the same way as surrogacy, same way as, you know, having birth children. It's just different routes, but kind of still the same kind of outcome, still that same kind of love at the kind of core of it, still the same lovely kind of, you know, highs and lows and experiences that everybody kind of gets a sort of sense of. And I just think, the more we can talk about it, I think the more kind of open the world kind of becomes, and life will just be a little bit easier for our children, because yeah, they, you know, they won't turn up at school and the first day be asked for a load of baby photos or pictures of their kind of, you know, their family, which they might not have, and they might have to kind of explain why that is, and people just to say okay and move on, as opposed to them have to feel like they need to defend it or question it or challenge it. And I think what I've experienced through, you know, online and offline, is the curiosity comes from people that have never considered the process, don't want to consider it, they're not at that stage of their life, or, you know, it's just not something they want to do, but just know nothing about it, or their view of it is based on a film they once watched, or an article they once read in a magazine, or, you know, a program they watched on TV that maybe just gives a slice of it, or a snapshot of it, or a historic view of it, but doesn't necessarily reflect, you know, how it is now and how life kind of works out. So I think, yeah, the opportunity to be able to, you know, to talk about it, to share stories, and hopefully the real joy that comes from, you know, creating a family in this way. Because I think quite often there's so many negative connotations around children that have been in care, and, you know, the negativity that comes from that. And you know, there is trauma, there is loss, there is all of that stuff. But there's so much, you know, buckets of joyous moments and, you know, really amazing stuff that you never think you're going to kind of experience, you get to experience through going to this process, and the reward that comes with that for the children, but also you as parents. I think, you know, we're not very good in the UK. I think in America they do an amazing job of talking about it, but I think in the UK we're so hidden and secretive about that whole kind of world that it's a real shame.
Yeah, but I mean, the more people like you keep talking, you know, people are,
yeah,
people,
and,
you know,
and getting the platform to share it and share those stories, I think, you know, that's massively important. It's, you know, the inclusivity that I think comes from, you know, take something like the Happy Mum and Happy Baby kind of community, the ability to share those different slices of parenting and life. I think it just enriches, doesn't it, everyone's understanding. I you know, listen and see stories and interact with content about, you know, people's experience, middle of the night breastfeeding, but I'm not going to do that, and that's not going to be an experience I'm going to experience, but I can appreciate and understand the challenges that come with that and how that might mentally impact someone. And that might make me a better friend for someone else, or it might make me a better ally to a work friend or whatever it is that's having that same kind of challenge. So, you know, you don't need to have to live in that experience to learn and to be curious and understand more about it. And I think that's what the beauty of kind of sharing those stories kind of gives, I think.
Yeah. James, if you could write a letter on parenthood, who would it be to and what would you say?
I think what I'd love to do actually is probably write a letter or take for coffee the social worker that we first dealt with, because I'd love to kind of colour in all of the other experiences that we've had since that initial meeting. I think we worked with her, I think, for about 3 months when we first went through the process, and then she changed roles and moved on. And I'd love to kind of almost sort of, you know, give her a few more chapters of the story of what we kind of went on to do and how our life kind of shaped up, because I think it must be a really challenging role to do that assessment, to talk about, you know, hypothetically families coming together, but then not to be able to see the outcome and to share that, I think must be really quite hard. So I'd love to have a kind of natter or write a letter and just say, this is what it was for us. This is what it actually turned out to be. You kickstarted it, but this is where we ended up, or this is where we are right now. It would be lovely to do that.
I would like you to finish 3 sentences for me.
Okay.
Being a dad means?
endless stress and worry, but the ability to, I think, to just smile probably more than I probably ever did before being a dad as well. So I think it's that balance.
Yeah, pulling your hair up, but at the same time, there's more joy.
But with a grin, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Slightly manic, between my head right now.
Yeah, it's probably not a good one to end on, actually.
Since having children,
I think I've become so much more tolerant and resilient, I think, to life and situations around me.
And I'm happy when?
I think when the children are in bed and I know that they've got through the day, they're chilled, they're content, they're sleeping, and yeah, it's like a job well done, I think.
Yeah. Have you got a glass of wine in your hand at the same time? I feel like that's going to complete
the picture. I hope so, or a big gin or something. So something to help me sleep, yeah.
James, thank you so much. It's been absolutely delightful chatting
to you.
It's
a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You know, your whole experience. I honestly can't tell you how much I do stalk your Instagram. And,
it's a pleasure.
Yeah. If Tom phones you one day and says, look, G is just knocking down things now, it's going to be your fault.
I'll bring the toolbox. It's fine.
There we
it's
go. Just come and patch up my botched jobs.
Absolutely. Yeah, all good. Lovely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for your time. Take care.
Happy Mum, Happy Baby is produced by Pixiu Productions Limited and is part of the Acast Creator Network. Have you noticed there's new pictures of me wearing some rather lovely hoodies and t-shirts? Yes, that's right. Happy Mum, Happy Baby clothing is here. We launched today, so you might even be the first to see it. Hurrah! Now, I love me a quote. I love a t-shirt quote, so I wanted to bring some of those quotes that really show how we feel. So my favourite is flipping shattered, because yes, I am feeling flipping shattered the majority of the time. And my second favourite is the Grow Love jumper in sizes for adults and mini-me's too.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.